Sometimes going to the grocery store can be chaotic. There doesn't seem to be enough time to check the list, make sure everything is there, search for the best prices, and take the time to make sure you get the best quality meat. So let ButcherBox help you out. Giving you peace of mind, ButcherBox delivers high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust straight to your door. No grocery carts required. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or hormones, 100% grass-fed, free-range, and crate-free. What more can you ask for? What about free shipping, customized box plans, exclusive member deals, recipe inspirations, tips, and tricks? You really can't go wrong with ButcherBox. Sign up at butcherbox.com/morningcup and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. Choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/morningcup and use code morningcup to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Today's podcast is brought to you by Newspapers.com, the ultimate destination for exploring the mysteries of the past. If you're fascinated by true crime, get ready to dive into the stories that made headlines. Newspapers.com offers a billion pages of historical newspapers from the U.S. and beyond, and you can search the entire collection in seconds. Their vast newspaper collection is a goldmine for eyewitness accounts, crime scene photos, news reports, and more. Whether you're interested in famous crimes or long-forgotten cases, Newspapers.com gives you a front-row seat to more than 300 years of history. For our listeners, Newspapers.com has a special offer. Use the code CUPOFMURDER for an exclusive 20% discount on your subscription. That's promo code CUPOFMURDER at Newspapers.com. Sign up today and start unraveling the true crime mysteries that keep you up at night.
There were two more murders 15 miles away.
When police arrived, they found the telephones and electricity lines.
We have a weird homicide.
A scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird...
Morning.
Cup of murder.
There are some cases that it seems everyone, no matter their location, knows the details of. Today's story is one of those cases. On April 16th, 2007, the nation and even the world was shook by the news of a horrific shooting at a college campus in Virginia. So if you like your coffee hot but your bones chilled, sit back and start your day with a morning cup of murder. Seung-Hoo Cho was born on January 18, 1984, in the South Korean city of Asan, where he lived with his family in a basement apartment before they immigrated to the United States in 1992. Entering the new country at the age of 8, Seung-Hoo's father hoped that the move would provide a better education for his children. And though it brought in little money, he worked hard as a self-employed bookstore owner. After finding out that there was a large South Korean expatriate community in Washington, the Cho family moved from Detroit and settled into the unincorporated community of Centerville in Virginia. Living just west of D.C., Seung-Hoo's father and mother opened a dry cleaning business, began attending a local Christian church, and shortly after the move, became permanent residents of the U.S. as South Korean nationals. Now, while the family seemed to be settling into their new environment incredibly well, some were concerned with Seung-Hoo's behavior, even at such a young age. Described as selectively mute and someone who showed little affection, an anonymous family acquaintance later recalled, quote, "Every time he came home from school, he would cry and throw tantrums, saying he never wanted to return." Believed to have been suffering from some unknown mental illness at the time, Seung-Hoo, who was also described as a good student and was not disliked by his young classmates, made his way to middle and high school, where he was finally diagnosed with social anxiety disorder in the eighth grade. Though there were later claims that he was actually diagnosed with autism, there were no records of such diagnosis. Seeking treatment for their son, Seung-Hoo's parents placed the boy in special education classes under the, quote, emotional disturbance classification. He was placed in speech therapy in hopes that his selective mutism would improve, and he received therapy until the end of his junior year. To make matters worse for the young boy, Seung-Hoo found himself the victim of schoolyard bullies, who targeted him both for his shyness and mannerisms, as well as his ethnicity. Former classmates would later state that he was a loner who didn't seem interested in interacting with his teachers or his peers, even with those who tried their best to include him. In 1999, when the Columbine High School massacre leapt into the news, Seung-hoo, a ninth grader, became fixated with the story and reportedly idolized the gunmen to the point where he wrote a school assignment that he wished to repeat their actions. The school contacted his sister, who relayed the information to their parents, and Seung-hoo was sent to a psychiatrist. After graduating from Westfield High School in 2003, Seung-hoo applied and was accepted into Virginia Tech, where he planned on majoring in business information technology. And because of federal law, his high school officials were prohibited from disclosing any record of his diagnosis, disability, or treatment without his permission, meaning that no one in Virginia Tech knew anything about his speech and anxiety-related issues when accepting him into their university. Eventually changing his major to English with the intentions of becoming a writer, a woman named Nikki Giovanni ended up teaching him in a poetry class in the fall of 2005, where she asked for him to be removed from her classroom due to what she said was a, quote, menacing behavior, a, quote, mean streak, and writing described as, quote, intimidating. Reportedly wearing sunglasses in class, she later said that Seung-hoo refused to participate, but would silently photograph his female classmates' legs under their desks and write graphically violent and obscene poetry to turn in as an assignment. Telling her department head that she would rather resign than continue having him in her class, Seung-hoo was removed, and finding his writing incredibly troubling, the department head, Lucinda Roy, contacted the police and administration to ask for guidance. Unfortunately, because he didn't make any explicit threats, there was very little that could be done. An action that I'm sure many regretted in light of what Seung-hoo Cho would later prove he was capable of. After the massacre that made him infamous, Lucinda Roy reportedly remarked that, immediately after finding out about the tragic event, she knew that Seung-hoo was likely the culprit. She had taught the young man in an introduction to poetry class the previous year and described him as, quote, actually quite arrogant and could be quite obnoxious, and was also deeply, it seemed, insecure. She even stated that she on multiple occasions told him to seek counseling, and when she tried to work one-on-one with him about the disturbing themes of his writings, she felt as though her life was in danger, and even came up with a code that her assistant would know meant that she needed to call security. These were not the only teachers to voice their concerns over the years, and students who knew Seung-hoo, at first describing him as simply a quiet young man, said he became more and more isolated as the years went by. On one occasion, classmates claimed that Seung-hoo actually went to a party but spent the entire evening in the corner where he began repeatedly stabbing the carpet in the girls' room. His roommates, who were present that evening, said that Seung-hoo was a reclusive man who they all agreed to avoid interacting with. They said he claimed he had a girlfriend named Jelly, an imaginary young woman who was a supermodel living in space, and that in the weeks before the shooting, they noticed his unusual sleeping schedule. One man later said that Seung-hoo stood in his doorway taking photos of him, placed harassing phone calls pretending to be his brother, who he said was named Question Mark, and received another call while on Thanksgiving break, and listened as his roommate claimed to be vacationing with Vladimir Putin in North Carolina. After introducing himself to girls at school as Question Mark and using the name to chat with them online, the roommates, who dropped their initial plans to befriend him, recalled how two incidents involving two different female students resulted in Seung-hoo being verbally warned by the campus police. Young women who felt as though he was stalking them, but did not press any charges at the time. It seemed like the young man who was previously seen as harmless was slowly shifting into something far more dangerous. So when Seung-hu sent an email to his roommate stating that he, quote, might as well kill himself, campus authorities were contacted and he was escorted to the New River Valley Community Services Board, where on December 13, 2005, he was given a psychiatric evaluation. There, the physician who examined him determined that he was, quote, mentally ill and in need of hospitalization, and was suspected of being an imminent danger to both himself and to others. Detained temporarily at the Behavioral Health Center in Radford, Virginia, pending a committal hearing, on December 14, 2005, he was released from the facility on the condition that he be treated as an outpatient. However, due to, quote, neither the court, the university, nor community service officials following up on the judge's orders, Seung-hu never received treatment. And because he was over the age of 18, there was little his parents could do to step in and try and help. His mother believed that church and spiritual healing was necessary, and in the summer of 2006, sought the help from various churches in North Virginia. She was told by some members that her son had demonic power and needed deliverance. They intended on meeting up with the family, but before they could do so, Seung-hu returned to Virginia Tech to start his senior year. That's where, on April 16th, 2007, at 7:15 a.m., he picked up two guns and began what was considered at the time the deadliest school shooting in U.S. history, the deadliest one-man shooting rampage in modern U.S. history, and the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. His first two victims were students Emily J. Hilscher and Ryan C. Stack Clark, who were found on the fourth floor of the West Ambler Johnston Hall dormitory. Over the course of the next 2.5 hours, Seung-hu returned to his room, rearmed himself, mailed out a package to NBC News containing pictures, digital video files, and documents, and then at 9:45 a.m., he crossed campus and entered Norris Hall, where in the span of just 9 minutes, he shot indiscriminately and killed a staggering 30 individuals and injured 17 more. Those who perished were Manal Panchal, 26, G.V. Loganathan, 53, Jarrett Lane, 22, Brian Bloom, 25, Matthew Gwaltney, 24, Jeremy Herbstritt, 27, Partahi Lumbenturan, 34, Daniel O'Neill, 22, Juan Ortiz, 26, Julia Pride, 23, Waleed Shalan, 32, Jamie Bishop, 35, Lauren McCain, 20, Michael Pohl Jr., 23, Maxine Turner, 22, Nicole White, 20, Liviu Librescu, 76, Jocelyn Couture Nowak, 49, Ross Almedini, 20, Austin Cloyd, 18, Daniel Perez Cuerva, 21, Caitlin Hammerin, 19, Rochelle Hill, 18, Matthew Laporte, 20, Henry Lee, 20, Aaron Peterson, 18, Mary Karen Reed, 19, Rima Samaha, 18, Leslie Sherman, 20, Kevin Granada, 45, and of course, Ryan Clark, 22, and Emily Hilscher, 19. Attacking faculty and students and reportedly firing off his weapon, quote, without even the slightest emotion on his face, police breached the area, and as they did so, Seung-hu Cho took his weapon and placed it on his own temple. Later connected to the first two victims via forensics, matching his shoe tread to the blood-stained print left in the hallway outside Emily Hilscher's room, as well as matching the weapons, in total, Seung-hu fired 170 shots during the killing spree from two separate firearms. Investigating further, police found a note in Seung-hu's room in which he criticized rich kids, debauchery, and deceitful charlatans, saying, quote, you caused me to do this. Though initial media reports claim that he was obsessed with Emily Hilscher and that he became enraged when she rejected him, investigators found no evidence that the pair even knew one another. claiming this was not a spur-of-the-moment attack. Sources say that Seung-hui went to a gun range at least 3 times before the shooting, had been preparing it for months, and that he began purchasing weapons, despite his mental health, in February and March of 2007, somehow passing the necessary background checks. The manifesto was part of the package mailed to the media, and though it contained rantings and some musings, it remained difficult to actually piece out what his motive truly was. In fact, in videos, the mild, meek, and quiet young man seemed like he was, quote, trying to turn himself into a Quentin Tarantino character. This was also around the time that investigators learned about the failings in his court-ordered mental health treatment and the vast oversights that left him untreated, unsupervised, and able to commit such a heinous crime. In the aftermath of the devastating shootings, Virginia Governor Tim Kaine convened a panel consisting of various officials and experts to investigate and examine their response. And when the 20-page report was released in August of 2007, it criticized the failure of educators and mental health professionals who came into contact with Seung-hui during his college years, who they said noticed his deteriorating health and did not help him. It also spoke of the misinterpretations of privacy laws and gaps in Virginia's mental health system, as well as gun laws that allowed him to legally purchase weapons used in the massacre, an event that remains one of many black spots in our nation's history. Thank you for joining me in my morning cup of murder. Please join me again tomorrow to hear what terrible thing happened on April 17th. Don't forget to rate and subscribe and let me know how you like it. If you want to help support the podcast, there's always Patreon or just sharing it with your true crime obsessed friends. And remember, stay safe.